This is 2021-0532 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Simmons. Good morning, Mr. Sweeney.
Good morning. Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, Colin Sweeney from the Cuyahoga County Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Simmons, along with John Martin. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and that's going to be handled by Mr. Martin. I'd like to start, obviously, just pick up midstream, because a lot of the issues are the same, with the separation of powers argument, which Justice Donnelly just asked about. The state, in their attempts to distinguish it, SB 201 from Bad Time, have essentially said, well, in Bad Time, it wasn't really part of the sentence, but in SB 201, it is, and therefore that's a distinction. But when you look at all of the statutes, and they're in our appendix, the statutes that imposed Bad Time or gave authority to impose Bad Time were a part of the sentence. It's explicit in the statutory language. As a part of the sentence, DRC may impose Bad Time. And the judge notified, just as they do here in an SB 201 type sentence, notified the defendant that Bad Time was a possibility. So all those things were true. But despite that, the court said it still violated the separation of powers doctrine. And the reason for that is because the decision related to how long beyond the sentence imposed by the judge a defendant could be kept cannot be delegated to the executive branch. And here I want to just transition to parole because I know there are some questions about that.
Go ahead.
If you can back up a minute, Mr. Sweeney, so how is an extension of time by DRC for some violation that does not go past the maximum prison term extend the time past the judicially imposed sentence?
Because and this goes to the difference with parole. When Mr. Simmons goes to prison, based on what the judge actually imposed time in prison, it's 5 years. It is not 7 years. The judge, just like with Bad Time, gave Mr. Simmons notice that the executive branch there's two condition precedents to getting that extended sentence. One is to be sentenced by the judge to 5 years. But the second act is entirely within the discretion of the executive branch. Whether Mr. Simmons gets that 2 years, that's not the judge's call. That's the executive branch's call. And that sentencing determination, which is what the executive branch is doing, invades the core responsibilities of the judicial branch.
So you concede that if the judge simply imposed a range of 5 to 7, and that's it, that would not violate the separation of powers.
That's correct. And in fact, and there was a question earlier about, well, aren't we sort of arguing against the defendant's interest or how can the presumption be wrong if an indefinite system is okay? And all of those same arguments were made in Blakely and Booker and its progeny. The fact that you can do one thing a different way doesn't make constitutional the way the General Assembly chose to do it in this case. And so same with in the Blakely case, the determination by the judge, and now switching to the trial by jury, of deliberate cruelty did not extend the sentence beyond the statutory maximum. But it did not matter because what Justice Scalia said in that case is the sentence, the amount of time the defendant actually serves in prison must be based solely, and that's an important word that I think the state routinely forgets, must be based solely on the facts found by the jury or admitted by the defendant. Here, if Mr. Simmons is kept beyond 5 years, it will not be based solely on facts found by the jury or admitted by the defendant. It will be based on facts found by an executive branch official.
And that's the exact same as any parole situation.
And here's where it's different, in my view, Justice, is that in a parole situation, let's say you have two offenders identically situated, one under SB 201 and one under parole. In the case of the person under SB 201, they will only stay there if the executive takes an action to keep him there longer. The reverse is true under parole. They have been imposed a total sentence. The only way they're going to get out early is if the executive takes action. Under a parole system, the executive branch does not have the authority to keep the defendant longer than the judge's imposed sentence. Under SB 201, they do. All that Mr. Simmons will do, based on what the judge found, based on the facts that were presented at that time, will be 5 years. Under a traditional parole system, like 5 to 25 years under pre-SB 2, the defendant has no expectation of earlier release. He's told 5 to 25, maybe the executive branch, as an act of grace, will let you out early, but you expect to be in there for 25 years. That's not what's happening under SB 201. It
but
flips
under,
it on
under set. SB 201, if the judge says, I'll use Justice Donnelly's comment, 5 to 7, mm-hmm. with presumption of 5, right?
Yeah.
If he's not held past 7, isn't that the same thing?
You're saying,
isn't that enforcing the judge's decision?
No, because the judge is not, by the judge alone, is not sentencing Mr. Simmons to 7 years in prison.
He's saying 5 to 7.
He's saying 5 years, and I'm going to let the executive branch decide whether you get those extra 2. And the difference is, and this is fundamental.
But he could have said, the judge could have said 5 to 6.
Well,
yes.
I don't think he could have said 5 to 6.
Oh, there's 5 to 7, there's 3 to 11, and a bunch of them.
You're saying that the judge could have sentenced, because this is an F2, could have sentenced them to up to 8 years.
Right.
Yes, that is true. But my point, as relates to the separation of powers principle, is the amount of time that Mr. Simmons has to serve. The judge set the bar based on the facts that were admitted to at sentencing of 5 years. That he really did not say, based on just solely on my sentencing, you could serve up to 7 years. What he's saying, and this is the problem with the bad time, is he's essentially just giving the defendant notice. No, hey, look, I'm giving you 5 years. But if you mess up in prison, not me, but this other branch of government is empowered to give you 2 more years. Essentially, it's a delegation of power from the legislature is taking power from the court and giving it to the executive branch.
There's nobody more caring about the power of the
court
than me.
Good. Then I'm talking to the right guy.
Okay. But what I'm asking is, if the judge says 5 to 7 and the defendant serves 7, it was under the judge's final judgment that the judge signed.
Your Honor, again, we disagree. He doesn't say, but if all he said was 5 to 7, that's an indeterminate sentence. And I would 100% agree with you.
With the presumption of 5.
Oh, great. But what the judge is saying is, look, you're going to get out in 5 unless you do something in prison, some other entity, not me, not the judicial branch, the executive branch, makes findings that extend your release date. If Mr. Simmons goes to prison, the executive sits on his hands, doesn't do anything, DRC doesn't do anything, he's getting out in 5 years. So the point is that the judge is not making the decision whether to keep him 7 years. It's the executive branch.
Is it?
But doesn't it matter that the defendant gets notice that it could be 7 years? I mean, the legislature, the courts do not willy-nilly come up with a sentence. They follow the statute and use their discretion where applicable in implementing those sentencing laws. So this sentencing law was designed by the legislature. And at the time that he's given the 5-year sentence, the law just says it could be as much as 7 years. Why is that a problem?
Because what matters is who decides whether it's 7 years. The judicial branch decides how long your maximum sentence is in prison. That has never been different, ever, in the state of Ohio. That has always been the case. Under pre-Senate Bill 2, it was indefinite. Your maximum sentence, let's say 5 to 25, was 25. Under the definite truth in sentencing system, you got a specific term of years. What's changed here is now the judge is saying, I'm giving you a 5-year sentence. That's the amount of time you're going to serve. But the legislature has said that the executive branch now has carved out part of the judicial pie. to decide whether my 5-year sentence is enough.
But there is notice, isn't there?
There is notice, yes. So the judge, but that was true with bad time. Exactly the same with bad time.
Is that because I see you're getting close to your rebuttal? Do you argue too that it's a violation of separation of powers for the executive to say this defendant has done great, has been responsive to rehabilitation, he should get out before his 5 years?
I do not think so, because that falls within sort of traditional parole. That's in fact what parole system pure indeterminate sentencing was. I'm sentencing you to 5 to 25. You don't end up serving the full 25 because the parole board lets you out early.
But in this instance, that could be triggered by DRC.
Right, but that was triggered under parole, too. I mean, the decision to let someone out early on an indefinite system was always the executive branch. So with that, I will reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vam, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Van. I'm an assistant prosecutor from Cuyahoga County, representing the state of Ohio in this case. And I would like to reserve about 5 minutes for Mr. Peterson to make some final remarks. Now, having had the opportunity here to listen to the questions and the arguments, I think largely what I intend to do with my arguments is to present a universal point that I think is dispositive of all of the assignments of error. And I want to hammer home just some key things that I think show why these propositions of law fail. And I do think the court here today has already hit on some of those points. And I think the universal key point is that when we look at the Reagan-Tokes Law, this was a comprehensive piece of legislation. It just wasn't one thing. It was 50 statutory amendments, 4 statutory enactments, and more importantly, this was a return to indefinite sentencing for felonies of the first and second degree. Now, it doesn't look exactly like the system of parole that we had before Senate Bill 2, but it's important to understand what the verdict, or the guilty verdict, authorizes in this case, or in any of these cases. It's very clear from the plain text of 2929.14 that the judge imposes an indefinite sentence. It's an indefinite sentence, and the judge selects the minimum term, and the maximum term is determined by a statutory formula. That's 2929.144. So I just don't see the argument here that counts.
Counsel, what about the argument that the time a person convicted of a crime under the scenario serves in prison should be based on the facts of the crime? And if there is a presumption of minimum time, let's deal with the sentence we've been talking about, 5 to 7. If the presumption is that you serve 5, if DRC invokes some violation or some procedure to say you're now going to serve the 7 or an additional year or whatever, the trigger for that is not based on the conduct of your crime. It's based on something that happened or did not happen while you were incarcerated.
Sure, and I think that ties into different propositions of law. What I will say in response to that is that we do have examples, and I think it was the system in Nebraska, the Greenholz case, where potentially there's an expectancy of release on parole. And even in that respect, the due process afforded in that case is minimal due process. So I don't think there's an issue there. I don't think there's an issue with Apprendi. Even under Hayman, I think what Hayman makes clear is that what needs to happen is that the judgment, the jury verdict, those facts need to authorize the maximum sentence. And so, I'm going to make it easy in a indeterminate sentencing scheme under this sample 201, you have qualifying felony of the first degree. And the judge says, well, the minimum term I'm going to select is 10 years. The statute requires the judge in that instance to impose the maximum term of 15 years. And so that's all under the statutory formula. So it is an indefinite sentence. There's no...
Counsel, help me. I'm still struggling with, I mean, from a policy perspective for violent criminals, to me, it makes sense for indefinite sentences because it allows the executive branch to individualize the prisoner. Did they do well? Did they not do well? Are they still a threat to society? Are they not? That makes sense. But when you give a range and you also then tell the executive branch that it's going to make that decision, as Justice Stewart said, on conduct that had nothing to do with the crime, but conduct of their behavior. And in addition to that, you give them guidance that they are presumed. To me, that's typically a weighing process that is or should be reserved for the judiciary. And tell me why you disagree with that.
I would say this. I think even in the context of parole, where we have an administrative code that tells the parole board what factors it should look at. I mean, by and large, what the parole board looks at in the parole context is a question of whether or not a person is still a threat to society, whether or not that person has been rehabilitated. So I don't see that much of a difference. And I think,
isn't the difference is you're presumed that you're going to be at the high end unless the parole board graces you with a time less than that, and in this case, you're presumed to be at the low end unless something happens. Whether there are due process procedural protections there is another question. But you're presumed to serve the minimum time unless something happens while you're there, and DRC hits you with, no, you're not going to do the minimum time.
I would say even that presumption, and that was a legislative decision, that doesn't create the separation of powers issue. Again, if we look at the fact that you have an indefinite sentence that was authorized by the court authorized the maximum sentence.
Well let me ask this a more friendly question. If there's a 5 to 7, they're indefinite sentence, what then did the legislature intend for those additional two, for what did the legislature intend to happen to have those two additional years served, if at all?
So under
the Reagan-Tokes law, if there's a 5 to 7 term, you're presumed to serve the minimum of 5 years, but the sentence is clearly for up to 7 years, correct?
Correct.
And it's judicially imposed. What then did the legislature intend to have those two more years invoked, if at all?
So, and I think this goes back to the characterization of what's going on here. If we look at the language of 2967.271, the language and the consideration for the DRC is whether or not to maintain that defendant's term of incarceration within that indefinite sentence imposed by the trial court. And I'll reference the court's decision in Bowers, a recent decision in Bowers. I think, it's different if you have, let's say, different indefinite sentences that could be imposed by the court, right? So an A1B rape where you can have 10 to life, if there's another fact under 10 that becomes 15 years to life, if there was force that becomes 25 years to life. So that's different than what's going on here, because what the DRC is doing when it's making its decision under 2967.271, it's not changing the minimum term. It's maintaining within that indefinite sentence.
So let me ask you another question, and I need you to humor me on this just a moment. But what if we looked at the additional time as a collateral sanction? If you think about felony non-support, it used to be the driver's license was suspended, and dealing with the circumstances of that collateral sanction was within the discretion of the trial court, for instance, to give driving privileges. So my concern is more with the procedural due process, and is it appropriate for the legislature to take that judicial review of the extra time as a collateral sanction away from the court and give it to the executive branch with nothing in the statute that would guarantee some kind of due process that we all assume would happen with the court in overseeing a collateral sanction?
Sure. And I think those concerns can be resolved by looking at the Eighth District's the lead opinion and the en banc opinion in Del Valle, what the lead opinion recognizes. And I think one thing I would mention is that there seems to be somewhat of a dispute. Is this like parole revocation or parole release? Our position is that it is like parole release. But what the lead opinion in Del Valle recognizes is that it doesn't have to be in the statute. Even if we look at the parole revocation statute, 2967.15, you know, there aren't detailed procedures in there. And I think that makes sense because the Constitution tells us, and as you know, it's been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court. We think it's more on the Greenholz side. That tells the DRC what procedures they need to have in place. And I think we can look to the fact that there's policies in place, things of that nature. And I don't think it's necessarily germane to what we have here. What we have here is a facial challenge. Is the statute constitutional on its face? And if the appellant's argument is that it's not constitutional on its face because the statute has no procedural safeguards, our response is that it doesn't have to be there. And even in Morrissey versus Brewer, where that's the parole revocation case, there's more safeguards implicated in that context. Nothing in Morrissey indicates that those protections need to be codified in statute. And another case this court can look to for guidance, again, it's instructive, but the 11th District, engaged in a similar analysis in State versus Moran. I think it is worth noting that, you know, we do have other appellate districts other than the 8th who've weighed in, and even the ones that have found the Morrissey safeguards are in play.
Mr. Peterson's time.
Okay, thank you. And I would just, again, I think overall what we have here is a system all of this is constitutional on its face, and to quickly and finally just address the potential forfeiture issue, I would just remark on just behalf of the state from the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, even if this court isn't inclined to, we could waive that forfeiture. I do think there are cases pending on the court's docket where it is in play. The court can easily lift a stay in one of those cases. And I would just mention the Green case, 2022-0341. State of Ohio would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the 8th District. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson.
Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. Well, I'm happy to answer any questions the court might have after the arguments so far today. I want to briefly try to respond to questions that Justice Donnelly and Justice Stewart, I think you were both asking, about the maintenance of custody based on conduct that occurs in prison. And that's no different than any type of parole decision. Every type of parole decision from time immemorial has relied on prison conduct as part of the reason to grant or deny release. That was
Yes, I agree with you. But as you're approaching the lower part of the range, you have no expectation, and the executive branch, it's up to them to decide based on their rules. They haven't been given a presumption that you are guided, executive branch, that they are to be released. That didn't exist pre-Senate Bill 2. All you could count on was going before the parole board at that minimum stage.
And I think I would turn back to Greenholz is my first response, and then discuss remedy and why that presumption doesn't matter. Greenholz also had a presumption, and the court there said merely because a statutory expectation exists doesn't mean that you're entitled to the same procedural and adversarial hearings that you would be as if you were a unconvicted defendant. And so I think Greenholz, even though it was in the context of due process, recognized that there is a hard line between someone who has been convicted and someone who is in prison, and a presumption related to parole decisions doesn't put you back in that new unconvicted position. And that's where I want to turn briefly to remedy, because I think remedy, while we believe the statute is constitutional in all respects, the appropriate remedy shows why the challenges here are misplaced. Because I think we all agree that if it were not for this presumption, then there would be no constitutional challenge to the statute whatsoever. And so the remedy would be the remedy that this court adopted in Foster, which is severing the unconstitutional portion and giving total discretion to the executive. In Foster, it was total discretion to the sentencing judge. And otherwise, Justice Stewart, you had asked about what the General Assembly would intend, and I know that's often a consideration in the court's severance doctrine. And it would be an odd thing to say that an act named after a woman who was kidnapped and murdered would result in the General Assembly intending to lower the sentence for everyone. As the Eighth District's en banc decision articulates fairly well, the General Assembly here wanted to return to an indeterminate sentencing provision to provide incentive to offenders to try to work towards rehabilitation. And so if the court were to find a problem, the appropriate remedy, we think, is the remedy the court in Foster had, which is to sever the presumption and return complete discretion to the executive. And so for these reasons, and the reasons articulated in the prior case, we would ask the court to affirm the decision below and hold there's no constitutional problem with the statute.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Merton.
Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, John Martin on behalf of Mr. Simmons. Several points on rebuttal. First, let's talk about remedy. If this court simply takes out the presumption takes out the presumption and leaves the indefinite tail, or the 50% tail, then you are not acting consistently with what the General Assembly did in the following ways. One, the General Assembly looked upon this as something that was going to be used for people who have misbehaved in prison and in a violent and have shown a threat of violence in the future. But if we go to a straight parole system, everybody is subject to parole. The F1 check fraud, who doesn't do anything wrong in prison, might still not get out at that presumptive minimum because it's simply up to DRC, or up to the adult parole authority in that situation. Two, with respect to the criteria that goes with the presumption, the General Assembly did not want to give the executive branch a blank check and say, stay in for any reason that the executive branch may or may not find, which is the difference between traditional parole.
Well, Mr. Martin, let me ask this. How do we treat two offenders equally sentenced, same time, generally same offenses, 5 to 7 years, one gets in, does his or her time, no violations, and the other one is saying, as soon as I get out, I'm doing the same thing, or displays some evidence that when the time arrives for release, this person is still a danger to the public? How do we treat them differently?
You treat them differently by how you treat them with respect to post-release control. You still have mandatory post-release control in every F1 and F2.
But for release, you're saying they should be released at their minimum time.
They are going to be released from prison. The conditions of post-release control can include an additional 6 months of jail, and the conditions of post-release control can include being locked up in a halfway house or community-based correction facility. So therefore, there are still ways to incapacitate the your offender number one from your offender number two, Your Honor. Now, with respect to severance, instead of traditional parole, the executive branch basically has a blank check. See, the one thing that's different between traditional parole and what we have here is that with traditional parole, if the executive branch does nothing, the defendant sits. The General Assembly gave us a situation where if the executive branch did nothing, the defendant walks. That's a big difference. Beyond that, contrast that with what we had in Foster. Right? In Foster, we had a situation where everyone was going to get a minimum and concurrent term unless this court severed. And that clearly was not what the judge wanted to begin with, because the judge's original sentence was not minimum and concurrent. And similarly, in our situation, the judge's sentence, the judge's presumptive sentence, is still going to be the same. And so accordingly, you have a situation. You don't need severance to make sure nobody gets a minimum sentence, okay? Because you're still, even if you just strike down the unconstitutional provision, the sentencing judge still has that range of 3 to 11 on an F1, still has the range of 2 to 8 on an F2. In Foster, a judge was going to have 3 on an F1 and 2 on an F2 in every case, and that's a big difference. That would have perverted the intention of the General Assembly. I have hit the end of my time. Chief Justice Kennedy, I appreciate the court's indulgence. And we would reiterate our prayer. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision. Marshal, please close court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Court has now been adjourned.